This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome to the big picture. You know, we had an economic crash that spanned between 2007, 2008, and of course affected the years that followed. After the economic recovery began in 2009, the folks at PIMCO, if you remember, termed the whole new environment in which we operate in the markets and the economy as, quote, the new normal. And remember what we've always said here on the program, that when people go through a paradigm shift, the first thing they do is they assume that whatever we've gone through has been temporary, and if we just work at it hard enough, we can get back where we were, rather than recognizing that you're in a whole new environment and that new rules will apply. But you know, as we look around us, Jim, here we are. We've been living in the new normal since 2009. And in all honesty, it seems like everything is the new abnormal, I guess, because if we look at the economic growth rate, the way markets function, the way we have the lowest interest rates historically, for that matter, and especially how frequently our policy experts have been wrong on the markets and the economy, you wonder why anybody's still listening to them or quoting them, because they keep getting it wrong. Would you want somebody doing surgery on you that had this success rate? So this is the new abnormal, which I guess we'd better discuss today so people understand it.
We're calling it the new abnormal because I don't care if it's anything from looking at interest rates, looking at the stock market, economic growth, technology, the financial system. Everything that you can think of today is so much different. And as we have spent over the years spending so much time talking about what the Fed's going to do, whether it's another quantitative easing program, whether it was taper, whether they're going to raise or not raise. But the fact of the matter is, interest rates are the lowest they've been in history. And for the first time in recorded economic history, we actually have negative rates. That's something we've never experienced before. I mean, when you think about it, where do people put their money? If you're an institution, if you're a pension, if you're somebody that's retired looking for safety, the obvious source for income and safety has always been the government bond market. Well, today, interest rates are lower than they are on what you can earn on a common stock. Nearly one-third of the outstanding debt is now negative. And John, we have actually got to a situation today where zero coupon bonds, and if you're an investor, bear with me, if you're not familiar, a zero coupon bond is, think of a U.S. savings bond where you buy them at a discount, you hold them, you don't receive any interest. So let's say you buy a savings bond for 50 cents, you hold it for 7 to 10 years, and at the end of 10 years, your savings bond is worth, let's say, a dollar. And that's what zero coupon bonds are. There's a stated interest rate. It accrues. You never receive it until the very end when the bond matures. We actually have zero coupon bonds where you would, let's say, buy a bond, John, tie up your money for 5 or 10 years, and your interest on it for that entire holding period would be zero. So we actually have zero coupon bonds that are no longer figuratively, they actually pay for the first time in history a bond that you would buy that basically says, as long as you hold this bond, you will never earn a cent. So the only way you make money on buying these kind of bonds is if you paid a dollar for them. And let's say 10 years from now, you're going to get a dollar back, but you're going to get no interest in between. You're hoping if rates go negative that somebody else will pay you maybe $1.10 to own that bond because they're looking for a safe place to park money. So for the first time, we actually have zero coupon bonds where they actually, you are guaranteed, if you invest in the bond, you are guaranteed zero interest rate. And the result is many of a lot of experts. I don't care if you're talking about Carl Icahn, if you're talking about Stanley Druckenmiller, you're talking about Bill Gross, you're talking about George Soros, the bond market has never been fraught with this kind of risk.
You know, it isn't just interest rates either, but with interest rates being this low, I would think what we're seeing right now is that this really distorts the stock and the bond markets, because the question is, how do you gauge where interest rates are headed? Remember, with the interest rate hike at the end of last year, we thought they were going up. And so the markets were pricing in rate hikes, but the rates went in the opposite direction. As we know, markets don't like instability. They're trying to figure out what's happening. And when it goes in a different direction, well, that throws the whole thing out of whack.
Well, it is, but here's the problem. There is so much money sloshing around. I forget what the latest figure. Central banks have created close to $19 to $20 trillion of extra money that's sloshing around the globe. Our Federal Reserve created over $4 trillion. The ECB is creating money. The Bank of Japan. All of that money is out in the financial system, and it's looking for a place to land. And so wherever that money goes, and it's so fickle, it could be in one sector one day, and all of a sudden, 2 months later, that sector goes out of style, and all of a sudden, money is going in another direction. It could be a risk-oriented asset, and then all of a sudden, something happens, whether it's Brexit or what happened at the beginning of the year, the money rotates out of another sector and goes someplace else. Quite honestly, in my 36 years in this business, I've never seen anything like it. And anybody with long investment experience, I don't care, you listen to Bill Gross, you listen to some of the market sages that have been very successful in their investment careers, they're saying this is very difficult to gauge, because the market is no longer operating on fundamentals, as we talked about. It's operating based on liquidity. And anytime there's a crisis, whether it's Brexit, whether it's what happened at the beginning of the year, central bank response is like a fire department. They come out and they take the hose out and they flood the markets with liquidity. And then once again, we're looking at higher asset prices.
Yeah, and if we look at all of the money that's looking for places to go, and we have these low interest rates, it seems like the name of the game now has become survival. They're scurrying around trying to find some place to generate some type of an income. It's almost like a spooky woods you're walking through at night, because not only are we at low interest rates, but off in the distance you hear the howls of politicos threatening to take more of what you have.
Well, it's permeated all of our economic system and financial system, John, and it's the problem we'll get into later on. Unfortunately, the people that make the rules, whether it's politicians or Fed chairmen, they don't understand how the economy works. I mean, let's take an example, the stock market. We began the year, the stock market went straight down for 6 weeks. Oil prices, commodity prices, bond prices, everything was falling except for treasuries, when treasuries were expected to be going up in interest rate. Instead, interest rates came down. So the one thing that we've seen in probably this last 7 years in this market recovery, the markets have become more volatile. You see this greater rotations in previous bull markets, like if we go back to the last decade, if you were in emerging markets, if you were in commodities, whether it was gold, oil, iron ore, ags, didn't matter. You could stay with that trend through the entire bull market. It was a long trending cycle that you could stay on board. Likewise, in the 90s and the 80s. You take a look at what has happened since 2009, it's given rise to what we call the RORO trade, or what we call the risk on, risk off. Beginning of the year, markets going straight down, we were in the risk off trade. So the acronym that you saw come to play this year was STUB, which was consumer staples, telecoms, utilities, and bonds, because we were in a risk off mode. Now take a look at what's happening with the markets, with injections of liquidity. You're seeing the risk on trade come into play with emerging markets, the spreads on junk bonds, the small cap stocks starting to rise. So it's a different market. And John, that happens every year. It's not just like, well, we had 18 months of the risk off trade. Now, you got a year or two of the risk on trade. It can rotate two or three times in the year. And for the first time, at least in my investment career, and probably since you'd have to go back to the 1950s, the dividend yield on stocks is actually higher than the yield on bonds, and that's because central bank liquidity and quantitative easing has completely distorted that relationship between bonds and stocks. Stocks are considered to be riskier investments, so you would be expected to get a higher rate of return, and not in the way of dividends, but let's say price appreciation. In bonds, were considered lower risk, they would have a lower interest rate, but you know, the interest rate that you get on bonds today has no relationship to the inflation rate, has no relationship to the fundamentals of the company or the economy. It is being distorted by large amounts of liquidity, and we'll get into some of the problems that it's now being created. Central banks have been lopping up so much government debt, driving down the yield, they're now turning their attention to corporate bonds, and they're buying corporate bonds, which distorts the economy as well, because in effect, the government is choosing which corporate bonds to buy. The corporate bonds they buy, the yield drops, and it gives a more favorable financing rate to that particular company. So you now have central banks interfering with the marketplace in terms of which way it functions.
Well, we know that the markets were worried about Brexit, sort of the theory that Europe is going to be unraveling for 2 days. You remember that? After the Brexit vote, we just had this furious sell-off that was going on. But ever since the markets have been going up, despite a lot of dismal market news, there seems to be a breakdown here.
Well, it's driven by liquidity. You know, think of inflation, and what we're seeing is inflation in financial assets. Too much money chasing too few goods. In this case, too few stocks, because not only is the stock market been shrinking in terms of outstanding shares, companies have spent trillions of dollars buying back stocks. Central banks are buying stocks. So it is liquidity driven. And if you take a look at, as we have talked about here, corporate earnings have fallen 5 quarters in a row. GDP growth has been contracting or decelerating for 5 quarters in a row. But what is happening is investors, these markets are being PE driven. In other words, investors are willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings. So you often hear market commentators or sage investors with experience talking about price earnings multiples are at record levels. If we take a look at valuations of the stock market, they're right at levels last seen in 1929. So it's just that money is going into the market. And just like the internet bubble, what drove the bubble? It wasn't the earnings. It was investors willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings. And so the whole market structure is being distorted. Now, some analysts will come in and say, well, if you discount future cash flow by lower interest rates, it makes stocks more valuable. But when interest rates are no longer market driven, they're artificially suppressed by central bank policies, all these traditional fundamental metrics that you would use to invest, whether you were investing in bonds or you're investing in stocks, are all now distorted. So money is trying to find a place to find a home, and they're bidding up anything that they can find with a decent rate of return. And so what that's doing is investors are simply paying more for the same dollar of earnings. And that's what's driving this market, John. It's not the fundamentals. It's just simply the world is awash with money because central banks are cranking out this stuff on a daily basis.
What are some of the other abnormalities you're seeing? I mean, we've already talked about interest rates and the stock market's response to everything. Is there something I'm missing?
No, one of the other abnormalities out there is the oil markets. I mean, think about it. In the summer of 2008, we were at $150 of oil. Oil dropped down into the low 30s during the financial crisis, then right back up and up into over $100 a barrel until the fall of 2014. And then we hit a bottom in the early part of the year where we got down to $26. And think about this. In 3 months, the price of oil doubled. We went from $26 to $52 in 3 months. Now we're back down into the 40s. And what really happened here, you know, because we were proponents of peak oil, we still are. We think that eventual day is coming. But technology changed the whole dynamics of the energy market. First of all, it disrupted and defanged OPEC. OPEC had a monopoly grip on oil. I mean, if OPEC wanted to drive the price of oil, they could do that by simply cutting back on production. If they wanted to bring the price of oil down, they could do that by overproduction. Well, what happened is we had technology that came in, and OPEC is no longer the marginal producer. The United States has been the most significant contributor to the price of oil in controlling the oil markets in the last 5 years. We've increased our oil production by over 4 million barrels a day. It was one of the reasons that Saudi Arabia in the fall of 2014 made the decision that they weren't going to cut back on production because it wouldn't do anything. All they would do is cede market share to other players, either U.S. producers, Russia, or other countries. So the energy markets have been impacting also our domestic markets. Now, initially, when the price of oil fell from, let's say, $110 a barrel, it got down to $80 and $60, it was a positive for the market because for consumers, all of a sudden, instead of paying $3 or $4 at the pump here, we actually got up to, I can remember there was one place in Coronado that was charging $5 for a gallon of gasoline. Well, when gasoline prices fell down to below $2 nationally, all that was, let's say, a stimulus to the economy because it put money in the pockets of consumers. But then eventually, as prices kept falling, what happened? The energy industry began to contract. Drilling rigs began to be taken off the market. Oil workers, you know, hundreds of thousands of oil workers were let go from the business. It began to impact the economy, and it was a major reason why corporate earnings peaked, because a lot of the negative earnings have been coming from energy company, everything from small companies to the big integrated oil companies like Exxon. So now all of a sudden there was a correlation in the stock market where falling oil prices were equated with falling stocks, and oil recovery was equated with rising stock prices. And we've seen that probably here in the last month when the price of oil dropped down to just dipped below $40 a barrel, which I think is a crucial point for support in the market. And as oil prices started to come back, the energy stocks started to respond, and the markets started to respond as well, because now falling oil prices now have a negative connotation indicating, oh my goodness, it's falling, it's too much of it, demand is not strong enough to absorb that oil. So it's an indicator of a weakening economy, which is associated why you see falling stock prices.
So as we see U.S. producers cutting back, I mean, they're cutting back on investments, on drilling rigs, and it would seem that given this, we're setting ourselves up for another energy shock very shortly down the road.
Well, absolutely, because it's not just the fact that the rig count is down. It's not just the fact that, you know, hundreds of thousands of oil workers have been let go. And if you've been out of work for over a year or more, you're probably looking for work elsewhere, maybe going into a different trade or a different industry. And the oil industry is not about to crank up and ramp up with investments, hire new workers on the flip of a switch. So not only is rig count down, but investment is down and the industry has been contracting. Now we're starting to see, the IEA just came out with a report this week that world oil production is falling behind demand in the second quarter. Oversupply is now starting to be cleared. It's estimated in the third quarter, non-OPEC production will be down by almost 700,000 barrels a day. And one of the reasons why we saw oil jump from, let's say, $26 to $52 a barrel is the fragility of the oil system. Because as the Canadian oil sands took a little over a million barrels, you had terrorist problems with the oil sector in Nigeria and Libya. We had 3.5 million barrels of oil that was taken offline. It just goes to show you that a vast majority of oil is in a very unstable part of the world, the Middle East, where the vast majority of oil reserves lie, but also things of quirks of nature, like in the Canadian oil sands, just goes to show you how vulnerable the energy sector is and how the oil markets can react very quickly. But here's something that nobody is paying attention, because everything, all the debates that you are hearing from analysts on the oil sector, they're talking about drilling rigs, they're talking about technology. The gorilla in the room that nobody is talking about is depletion. And depletion is basically when you drill a well, eventually the production of that well begins to decline as more of the oil is taken out of the ground. And depletion is running at 3-4% a year. That does not stop despite economic growth. It does not stop with whatever the Fed's doing. It does not stop if the economy's in a recession. If you're producing a well that's been in production for a while, and especially a lot of these new shale plays, which are shorter-lived projects, that is continuing. And the more important problem that we are setting ourselves up for a shock down the road is oil companies and OPEC itself is not reinvesting. OPEC is not reinvesting is because the vast majority of OPEC countries are past their peak in production, and they are running major deficits to the point that Saudi Arabia, one of the largest producers within OPEC, is actually having to raise money in the debt markets and actually thinking of selling a public interest in its oil company, Aramco. So forget the rig count. If you want to know what's going to happen in the future, watch reserve replacement. The major oil companies are only replacing about 70% of their reserves. And what that's telling me is you got a warehouse out there. Yes, we have supply that's in inventory that's sitting around on tankers or oil storage facilities, but the oil companies themselves are not replacing everything they're producing. They're only replacing about 70% because they're not making the needed investments. And that's just not taking place in non-OPEC producers. It's taking place within OPEC itself.
Okay, but the economy itself, you know, its recovery would seem to have been abnormal, because for a while we're chugging along and then all of a sudden we have a negative quarter in GDP. Remember, the most recent GDP figures came in way under what the experts had said, which brings up the other issue is the experts always seem to be wrong. We seem to have these much more rosy projections of where the economy is going. And of course, the politicals really love to grab onto this one and to use that. And then it turns out to be wrong, which everyone seems to fail to remember what it was they projected and said.
Well, I mean, it is. And what is alarming, it's not being covered by the press. In fact, there's almost like a media blackout in how fast the economy has been decelerating. And that's a problem. It should be an issue that's being brought up in the political campaign, but the media is completely silent on this matter. I mean, very few outlets are really talking about this trend. I mean, when the economy grew at 0.8% in the first quarter, and then typically in the second and third quarter in this economic recovery have been the strongest quarters of the year, and then the economy slows down in Q4 and Q1. Well, you know, we're averaging 1%, but more importantly, John, since this economic recovery began in the summer of 2009, it is the worst economic recovery on record since World War II. Now, that in itself should tell you something, but what makes it even more outstanding as a statistic, bear in mind that the government applied $10 trillion of stimulus. By the time Barack Obama leaves office in January, he will have added $10 trillion to the national debt. And just like his predecessor, George Bush, added $5 trillion, he doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion, but the economic growth rates under Bush were in the 3% range. They were at a much higher rate, not as high as, let's say, the 80s and 90s, but, you know, certainly a lot better than where we were. The average growth rate when you come out of a recession, especially the first year or two coming out of a recession with the stimulation of lower interest rates, the economy typically grows at 4, 5, and 6%. We have seen the average growth rate since this recession began is 2.1%. So we've been growing at probably two-thirds of where we should be in that 3% range, and we've been growing at one-third of where we should have been coming out of an economic recession. So the worst recovery in 75 years, and what makes it even more pronounced is the fact we've had massive stimulus. The Fed printed $4 trillion, brought interest rates to zero. Much of the world is negative, so it's not just us here. And plus, the government spent an additional $10 trillion in efforts to stimulate the economy. Welfare's up, unemployment's is up, transfer payments are up, all kinds of giveaways are up to keep this economy afloat. And that's why when you take a look at the economic numbers, the only thing that's holding up the economy is the consumer, and much of that is being held up through transfer payments. The problem is with transfer payments, what happens when the transfer payments stop, or let's say they're cut back? Let's say that you are on unemployment and your unemployment runs out. What happens if you don't have a job? Or what happens if they start to cut back on food stamps? Or what happens if they keep raising your Medicare and medical premiums? All of this, John, is creating a level of uncertainty.
You know, one surprising thing you've seen is that the media have been really silent about the things we've been discussing here on the program, because as I pointed out to somebody recently, this is what's going to determine where we're headed as a country, not some of the stuff that's being debated by the politicos and by the presidential candidates. And it's not even brought up much in the financial media, because they're always trying to project where stocks are going, et cetera, et cetera. And they're not as much interested in this.
Like I say, you know, economic statistics, a lot of the economic numbers that we get from the government are adjusted. And when it comes to whether it's the unemployment rate or, you know, for example, the unemployment rate reported 2 weeks ago, the economy created 255,000 jobs. But those jobs were seasonal adjustments, meaning they were statistical adjustments to the actual numbers. In the month of July, the economy actually shed 1.2 million jobs. And that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of people that are angry out there, because it doesn't feel like an economic recovery, especially if you're one of those 1.2 million people that lost your job in the month of July. But what is the financial press and what's the administration talking about? Gosh, we just created 255,000 jobs. There were 255,000 statistical jobs that were created with seasonal adjustments. And economic numbers are always adjusted because the government doesn't have, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics doesn't have, complete information. So what you look at are trends. The fact is, business investments, which is a major portion of GDP, have been contracting for 3 quarters. Inventories have been liquidating for 5 quarters. Profits of corporations have been contracting for 5 quarters. The labor market has been decelerating by almost 50,000 jobs per month. In other words, the number of jobs we're creating in 2016 are about 50,000 less than the jobs we were creating in 2015. So the job numbers are distorted. And the other thing is, despite the lowest rates in history, instead of stimulating credit and economic growth, John, consumers are, instead of opening their wallets, they're socking money away. And this is one of the things the Bank of Japan found when they announced negative interest rates. Now, when people hear that, they go, it's like, John, it's like people are saying, I don't completely understand what's going on out there, but something's not right here, and they don't feel good. There's a high degree of uncertainty. And what do people do when they're uncertain? They start piling up cash because they said, you know what? It just seems like a storm's coming. So negative interest rates now, contrary to what the central bankers think, are communicating fear, and they create uncertainty with investors and consumers. And the fact is, you know, if you're listening to this program as a consumer, you only spend money when you are feeling confident about your job, you're feeling confident about the future. Despite whatever the political polls are, 70% of the people in this country feel we're going in the wrong direction and something is wrong with the economy. And they have a right to be, because there is something wrong with the economy. And consumer knows that something's wrong, John. And that's why whenever these central banks come out and say, you know, QE2, QE3, or negative interest rates in Japan, or the ECB is going to buy bonds, or the Bank of England is going to buy bonds, it's starting to backfire and create the opposite results. Recently, last week, when the Bank of England lowered interest rates, they also said through their quantitative easing program, they were going to launch a program to buy corporate bonds. But what is happening is they're getting the reverse impact of what they thought. A lot of owners, institutions of those bonds are saying, I don't want to sell you a 3% bond. I don't want to sell you my 4% bond, because once you give me that money, I'm no longer going to be able to get a 3% bond or 4% bond. I may only be able to get 0.5% or 1% bond, or in a worst case, a negative interest rate bond. So things are starting to have the opposite effect of what central banks think is what they intend to do in terms of the impact it's supposed to produce. Instead, it's producing the opposite effect.
So what you're saying, I think, is that we have a two-tiered economy here. I mean, for right now, the consumer seems to be okay with transfer payments. The job market's better. Housing prices are up. People are happy about that. But on the flip side of that, businesses are not investing and government is not investing. And that would seem to raise some red flags about where we're headed.
Well, and the reason is because we have now created an environment of uncertainty. I mean, if consumers are feeling uneasy about negative interest rates or zero interest rates, imagine if you're a business. Are you going to go out and build a new factory with your cash because you think, you know, growth is going to be, let's say, increasing, the economy is going to expand? No. What you're doing is you're going out and you're buying back your stock, you're increasing your dividends, and if you're running, if you don't have the cash flow to do that, the one thing you are doing is you're taking advantage of lower interest rates to increase the debt on your balance sheet, and you're actually borrowing money to pay out dividends or to buy back your stock. And so the investment that is taking place with businesses are the kind of investment that's doing nothing to stimulate the economy and create more jobs. So growth has been struggling to achieve what we call escape velocity. And the only thing that's holding up the economy right now is the consumer. That's 70% of GDP. But the economy is slipping and moving towards recession. The central bankers don't see that, because if they did, the Fed wouldn't be talking the way it is, and the Fed may end up finding themselves in a situation where this continues to slip with the election uncertainty, interest rate uncertainty, economic uncertainty, financial market uncertainty, and the Fed could end up being just like the Bank of England that got up to, let's say, 0.5% on their equivalent Fed funds rate, which is where we are here in the U.S., and the Fed could end up lowering interest rates. They're already calling into question with some of these economic numbers whether the Fed is going to go in December, where they're expected to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. So non-consumption, that's business investment, government investment, is not picking up. So the economy is operating at a two-speed economy. Consumers are still growing, but ex-consumption, if you take a look at manufacturing, John, it's now in recession. And the other thing that is also worsening is we're seeing falling productivity. And productivity means that you're simply producing more output for goods in the economy with the same level of labor. And that's not happening. And it's mainly due to lack of investment. Businesses simply aren't investing. Non-residential investment is down at record levels and never fully recovered from the recession of 2007 and 2009 for good reasons, because taxation and regulation are strangulating the greatest job creators in this country, which are small businesses.
You know, I would think something we've talked about a long time ago, I remember here on the program too, was the impact of technology in contributing to the changing environment, the rapid technological change. As a matter of fact, just a few years back, I can't remember when they first came out, we didn't have smartphones or iPads. We did have cell phones, but even those were new in the late 1990s as far as people having them, and so they're relatively young. Internet was young, that we didn't really have the social media the way we do today, and certainly not the degree of commerce conducted on the internet that the way we did 10 or 15 years ago, which in many cases has created a headache for states who seem to be missing out on the sales tax for a lot of this stuff.
Well, you're right, because the technological transformation now is we're having a technological revolution occur in our economy every 6 to 7 years. I mean, if you take a look at what's happening with robotics, is transforming manufacturing. The new plants that they're building are going to be run by robotics, and that means you can have more output with less labor and fewer workers. So the factory of the future is going to have less workers in it making more stuff than the factory of the past. The second thing is the new factory worker requires a higher skill set and a higher education skill set than, let's say, the factory worker of the past. And so a lot of the people that are coming into the workforce simply do not have the requisite skills to work in these factories. And that's why you're seeing these partnerships take place with a lot of large industrial companies that are partnering up with junior colleges and coming up with, John, almost reminds me of the guilds of the 14th century, where they're coming up with these two-year certificate programs where you will have the skill set, the math, the computer skills, programming skills that you need to work in a modern day factory. And another thing that's coming, folks, get ready. Okay, you're used to your smartphone, a smart home, you're used to your iPad, all this technology. Look forward in the next 10 years, you'll probably be driving an electric car. It might be self-driven. And also, you may be having a domestic robot. There's a company already, it's iRobot, that makes these it's like a little sweeper that mops and sweeps your floor. You're going to have domestic robots. That's coming in the next 10 years. And you're right, John. If you look at the internet, it's transforming economic commerce. I mean, take a look at the impact that Amazon is having on the retail space. So we did an extensive interview about 2 years ago with probably one of the most astute analysts in the retail space. And I remember one of the things he said, in the next 10 years, you will see 40% of the malls, shopping malls, and retail establishments simply disappear. The malls of the future are going to be smaller. They're going to be different. They'll be more entertainment oriented. It's almost like every month or almost every single week, a number of retail establishments that are announcing they're closing stores. Here in our own town, Nordstrom's has three stores here in San Diego. They're closing down one of their stores, and it's not just Nordstrom's. Macy's doing the same. And so you're seeing a contraction in the retail space as economic e-commerce takes over and replaces much of what we're used to doing at the shopping mall. You take a look at social media. It's changing the way we communicate. LinkedIn is changing the way the employment market works. The internet has done away with the monopolies of newspapers and TV, television, and newspapers used to be one of Warren Buffett's favorite monopolies. Well, they've lost the monopolies. I mean, think about this. Amazon bought the Washington Post for $250 million, a company that one time that was worth tens of billions of dollars. And take a look at what Google and Facebook have done to the advertising space. And if you want to look at something even more profound, that I don't think we can even get our handle on how profound this is going to be, is lifespans are increasing. And if, listen to this statistic, if you have a child that is being born today, that child has a 50% chance from the date of birth to live to the age of 104. Think of the impact that's going to have on government, the impact it's going to have on pension funds and entitlements in retirement. You know, the days that, you know, you retire at age 60, 62, 65, those are going to go away. 20% of individuals in this country age 65 are continuing to work. Most individuals today will have longer working careers instead of 30 to 40 years. It's going to be as much as 50 to 70 years. And we're talking about one of the most greatest paradigm shifts that we have, that we've seen in the history of the world. I mean, we are literally making history on almost a daily and weekly basis.
So bringing us full circle here, we are going through a paradigm shift, which, yes, it's different than previously, but it also seems to be abnormal from what has been previously experienced. I mean, it's reshaping the economy, markets, society. So as we're functioning in this whole new environment, what then are the investment implications?
You know, if you take a look at, as I said, you know, we used to look at the markets, if you're investing in stocks or bonds, they were driven by fundamentals. It was more transparent market. You knew what the economy was doing. You felt comfortable with the numbers. You know what earnings were doing. So we're moving from, I would say, a more transparent market to one that is more volatile. Just take a look at the volatility index in a graph of the VIX over the last 7 years. And the other thing that we're seeing is, in this kind of market, you're seeing almost internet-type valuations for companies like a Facebook or a Netflix is, there's such a lack of growth in economic growth and company growth. A lot of the earnings increases that we've seen have been driven by stock buybacks, which reduces the number of shares, so there's more earnings to be spread out over fewer shares. And investors are looking all over the globe, and finding growth is very hard to do. So when you do find it, you overpay for it. And if you looked at, we went from that sort of inflationary environment of the last decade to what I call a disinflationary environment, although I think we're at a pivot point, and that's going to change in the next 12 months as governments face a recessionary climate and they resort to helicopter drops. And we've gone from peak oil, as we were in the last decade, to a world that is awash with oil. So I think that day of reckoning has been postponed. And what is driving markets today is liquidity. It's not earnings. And so basically what that translates into is, as an investor, you're going to have to pay more for a dollar's worth of earnings. And what it also means as an investor is you're going to have to be flexible. You're going to have to shift. The day that you went and bought a stock and just held on to it, unless you were fortunate enough to catch on to Facebook or some of these social media stocks earlier, or the big growth companies, there's going to be more rotations and more rotations and more volatility. It's just the new abnormal. That's the world we live in.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
One of the most fascinating events in nature is when thousands of animals or insects group together into a swarm and act as a single collective entity. But do we see the same type of phenomena when it comes to certain events? Joining us on the show today is Eric Haddock, editor and publisher of Inside Track and Weekly Relay. And Eric, in one of your most recent reports, you discuss the cyclicality of food crises around the world, including the topic of swarming. Now, I think when a lot of people think of perhaps food crises and swarming, the first thing they might think of is locusts eating everything in sight. But you look at this from a slightly different angle in terms of events. Would you mind telling our audience a little bit more about how cycles and swarming are related?
Yeah, sure. And thanks for having me back, Chris. It's always a pleasure. When I refer to a swarm of cycles, it's really emphasizing or highlighting that principle of synergy and the grouping of multiple events or predictive characteristics increase the percentage chance and the probability of something happening. It even goes back to your old proverbs of two keeping warm together and a cord of three strands is not easily broken. The greater concentration of those events coming together in a pretty narrow window of time, to me, that's the highest percentage chance of related events taking place. For instance, I've talked about when I look back over hundreds of years of earth events, earthquakes and volcanoes, and you'll get one school of thinking that says, oh, well, you know, we've always had earthquakes and volcanoes, which is accurate. You always have. But to me, it's when you see the intensifying and accelerating combination of multiple earth events in a narrow window of time, and you see that duplicated and cyclically very consistent throughout time. That's more what I'm focused on. So, you know, when I'm looking back over Earth events and studying the timing and cyclicality of it, I'm not looking for a single event. I'm not even looking for necessarily the biggest and most major earthquake or volcano, although a lot of times that does coincide with the swarm. But I'm looking for the synergy of the events where it really corroborates that something is going on that perhaps we don't understand yet, that the timing of something is very consistent is very rhythmic, even if scientists and geologists have not figured out that precise trigger. And so again, it's just that it's the synergy of things that I'm looking for. And that's even how I trade as far as using technical indicators. To me, it's most advantageous and you've got the best timing and place to enter the market when you have multiple schools of thought, multiple technical indicators coming together at one point in the market and saying, yes, this is where a big move should take place. So it is that synergy that really increases the probability of an event.
And welcome back to The Big Picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, just as we discussed in the first part of our program today, The Big Picture, the abnormal world, we can look back as the place where that happened. The change would be the financial crisis spanning 2007 to 2009, because it's now redefined everything where we are by establishing an environment that we've never really been at before.
It really has. But, you know, the one thing that is really disconcerting and probably one of the main reasons to explain what we see going on today is we're living in a world that the policymakers who heavily contributed, and John, you've often commented on this on the show, that the people that created the mess actually came in and said, we're the ones to fix it. And what they do when they fix it is actually make the situation much worse than it is. And if you take a look at why did we get in the mess that we did in 2007 and 2009, was simply too much leverage and too much debt. So what did we do as a policy prescription is we came out with Dodd-Frank, heavy regulation, a very activist monetary policy. John, the monetary policy that we've seen coming out of the financial crisis is unlike anything we've ever seen in recorded human history. And more importantly, what our policymakers did is, well, too much debt got us into the crisis. How are we going to get out of it? We'll add more debt. So the creation of more debt to solve a debt crisis. So we use something that caused a crisis to solve the crisis. So we got too much debt. We'll just add a lot more debt. And if you take a look at just some of these figures, I mean, we were worried about China, for example, and its economic growth in the first quarter. China is a bubble waiting to burst. Since the crisis began in 2007, China has increased its debt from $7 trillion to $30 trillion. I mean, John, that is a lot of money. Even though they're the second largest economy in the world today, that is a lot of debt. And unfortunately, one of the reasons that we've had such anemic economic growth is the economy is being strangled by taxation and regulation. It's strangling the economy here. The same thing's going on in Europe, and the same thing is going on in Asia, especially Japan. And it's funny because when I started my investment career back in 1980, you know, it was taxes and inflation. Now it's taxes and regulation.
You know, if we take it back to, well, where would we start? The Community Reinvestment Act in the early 1990s, which required, now that was during the Clinton administration, but it required banks, it virtually strong-armed banks into making unworthy loans. And then we deregulated by getting rid of Glass-Steagall. That was a Republican Congress, a Democratic president. Then the Securities and Exchange Commission and Commodities Futures Exchange got rid of leverage restraints, and all of this allowed investment banks to get into speculation instead of lending so that they wouldn't have that exposed risk. Recalling Glass-Steagall came in back in the 1930s. Then when everything blew up in their faces, they went back to over-regulating as a response. It reminds you of someone trying to drive down the road by driving into the ditch on the right side of the road and then getting out of that and driving immediately into the left ditch on the other side of the road. You know, it's what I call ditchism. And that, of course, just creates the instability that we see because you're ricocheting back and forth.
It's not only that. I mean, something needed to be done. They should have never got rid of Glass-Steagall to begin with. It worked and it functioned well. But then when they got rid of it, it allowed banks to become investment banks. And instead of lending, they got into speculation, which is what's going on in the derivative market. I mean, how many times have we seen crises after crises with an investment bank that got into trouble, or a bank got into trouble through speculation, just like J.P. Morgan lost $6 billion in the infamous whale trade. So what they did is they wanted to reduce leverage, which was a good thing, but also in the way they did it, they made the markets less liquid. A lot of the investment banks, large banks, have withdrawn, shut down their departments in the bond market. And what has happened is it doesn't take that much to make major movements in the bond market. Today, the bond markets could be just as volatile as the stock market. Nobody's really talking about it. We've seen movements in the bond market, John, that are equivalent to 500,000 point drops in the Dow. And nobody's talking about that. I mean, just take a look at what happened in 2013, what happened in the fall of 2014. I mean, we've seen things we have never seen before. And a lot of it is a result of the policies and regulations that have been put in place. And central banks are still pursuing policies long after the crisis has passed. In other words, you know, one of the criticisms you'll see of the Fed today, they should start raising interest rates going back to, let's say, 2012 and 2013, instead of finally waiting to December of 2015. They should have done this 3 or 4 years ago when the economy was somewhat healthy compared to what they allowed to take place with additional QE. And also, don't forget, the more bonds that governments sop up through their quantitative easing, that's less quality bonds out in the marketplace for the private sector, for pension funds, for insurance companies. So there's all kinds of distortions. And the other thing is, what's that saying, John? Was it Einstein that said that doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, is the definition of stupidity?
Or at least an indication of neurosis, right? Doing the same thing over and over and expect a different outcome.
Yeah. And how many times have we talked here on the program of what the Fed projects, what they think they're going to do, and then they find out they have to retreat because the economic results they projected would take place as a result of their policies never happen. It's happened every single year in this economic recovery. Not once has the Fed got the economic growth rates right, just as in 2016, they have not got it right. I mean, they've got to be thinking, John, that, you know, earlier in the year, they thought we would be hitting close to 3%, then they scaled it back to 2.8, then 2.6, and then 2.4%. And here we are, the first half of the year is over. The big bounce they thought was going to take place in the second quarter didn't take place. The economy is growing at 1% now, and they're projecting 2.4%, which means the balance of the year, we're going to have to grow at over above a 3% growth rate to average a 2.4% growth rate. It's just not going to happen. And so the problem is the experts that did not see this crisis coming are now using policies that, in my estimation, John, are going to make the next crisis even greater than the one we've experienced.
Well, now that we are in the new abnormal and we're trying to dodge the rocks as we navigate through this, what would you say are the major risks that we're facing right now?
I would say there are probably three that really strike me. Number one, the incessant growth of debt in the U.S. and the global economy. As I mentioned, George Bush doubled the national debt. Obama doubled the national debt. The only difference is the numbers are much bigger. Obama doubled from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. What's the next president going to do? Double from $20 trillion to $40 trillion? I mean, we know in 2015, 100% of government revenues will go to Social Security and Medicare. There won't be any money for defense, no money for interest payments on the debt. That's something you should think about, how we're going to handle that, or even to run government itself. And the thing that's really frightening, it's surprising that our large institutions have not learned this, is the derivative market. I mean, we have a derivative market that's over $600 trillion, around $650 trillion. John, there is no way in the next derivative crisis that central banks have the wherewithal and the firepower to put out a fire if something erupts in the derivative market. And what they've done through all of this is the system that has emerged from the financial crisis is more fragile than it's ever been. And we just don't have the proper institutions and the right regulations to prevent the next crisis. And there's this false sense of security that you're getting from government. First of all, the media and the government isn't talking to you about what's happening underneath the economy. Nobody's talking about the kind of things we're talking about here on the program. That's number one. Number two, they said, oh, we've got Dodd-Frank. Too big to fail is not going to happen. I hate to tell you, folks, next time we get this crisis, you're not going to get bailed out if you're in a bank. You're not going to get bailed out if you're in investments. And we'll get into in a second here that the implications of the derivative markets and what that might imply. But central banks have made it clear, it doesn't matter, this stuff isn't working. We're going to do whatever it takes to destroy wealth through inflation and currency devaluation. Because as I mentioned, you take a look at all these economic growth projections, when they don't materialize year after year after year after year after year, once you kind of sit back and say, wait a minute, what we're doing isn't working. Maybe we need to rethink our economic models and what we're doing because it's not producing the results that we project. But that's not happening.
You know, I remember during the last crisis, you wrote quite frequently for the website about the derivative market. This is always the, not the gorilla, it's the dragon lurking in the background. And you could see it there, whether we talk about AIG or credit default swaps, it was Merrill Lynch going under, all the things that we saw. Wasn't that one of the areas of just terrific exposure?
Well, it is. I mean, we have a debt pyramid. I mean, think about this. Global debt since 2007 has grown by almost $60 trillion. We are now over $200 trillion globally. So a crisis that was caused by debt, our policy experts came up with a solution to add more debt to the crisis, like pouring gasoline on a fire. And the banks, the too big to fail, banks got even bigger. And we did a show, I think, a couple of weeks, and we talked about the derivative exposure of just the large investment banks. I mean, if you take a look at JP Morgan, their ratio of derivatives to the shareholder equity is 275. You look at Citibank, it's 270. You look at Goldman Sachs, oh my goodness, it's like 570. If you look at Bank of America, it's 151. And the problem is, as a result of the financial crisis, there's fewer investment banks, fewer big banks. The banks got bigger. In other words, the big guys got even bigger, and they're less liquid. And the real problem is these credit default swaps that are out there, which are so much different than the way regular insurance is handled. Instead of like, John, if I'm a life insurance company, or let's say an insurance company, I sell you a life insurance policy, I sell you car insurance or medical insurance, I'm required to take your premium and keep it in reserve. So against that rainy day, when I actually have to pay out on a settlement, somebody passes away, your house catches on fire, or you get in an automobile accident. With credit default swaps, that income is booked as revenue rather than reserves, and so it's handled much different. In the next crisis, this market is just so huge. I mean, think of what central banks had to do. I mean, the Bloomberg article came out a couple of years after the financial crisis. The Fed backstopped, I think it was like $9 trillion of assets from banks to investment banks to the commercial paper market to money market funds. They were backstopping everything, but that was much different. I mean, the Fed started out with a balance sheet of about $700 billion. Now it's $4.6 trillion. So central banks don't have enough firepower to handle with their leveraged balance sheets. The Fed is just one giant hedge fund as the ECB or the Bank of Japan. So it's going to be much, much different in the next crisis because there's, number one, more leverage. Number two, the system is more fragile. And number three, it's less liquid. And that tends to amplify problems when they occur.
You talk to people, why there's so much emotionally charged energy in the country. People are sensing that things are uneasy. I mean, we've traipsed along here. We're, what, 7 years? Actually, it's longer than that, really, since the financial crisis began. And, you know, people think it's okay. The politicos are telling us, elect me and we'll make it more okay. And you and I both know there are hazards fraught on either side of these courses we're navigating.
People, I think, forget what actually happened in 2008 and 2009. I mean, the financial system globally came close to collapsing. Economic activity came to a halt. The financial markets collapsed. I mean, lenders literally stopped lending. The commercial paper market stopped working. And even worse, counterparties to these derivative contracts refused to honor their obligations. It's one of the reasons the Fed had to come in with AIG, who was the counterparty on a lot of these credit default swaps. AIG didn't have the money. So we had to bail out AIG to the tune of almost $200 billion. We had to bail out the automobile companies because a lot of these automobile companies like GM had financial subsidiaries that were invested in derivatives and loans. They were insolvent. So the whole financial system is built on this thin veneer of trust. The trouble is the world is losing its ability to generate the income to service its debt. And we know that debt is either gotten away in several ways. Number one, it's paid for. In other words, you actually pay back your debt. Number two, it's defaulted. Somebody just says, can't pay us. Sorry, gone bankrupt. Or number three, it's inflated away. Or basically, it's devalued, which is the fourth. And that's what I think that we're going to head towards to service this debt, because the economy is not generating enough economic growth to generate the revenues to pay the debt. The government is leveraged up. Corporations have leveraged up. Individuals less so. And so the only way that we're going to get out of this is either to inflate or devalue. And I suspect what we'll see is what happened under Roosevelt in 1933, where you wake up one day and the dollar will be devalued by 40-50%. So what you thought you had in the bank that was worth a dollar will no longer be worth a dollar, be worth 50 cents. And the problem is it's too heavily burdened with debt. And do you hear that discussed anywhere, John, in this political campaign?
No, because then the conversation would have to switch from being giveaway oriented to how are we going to tighten up the belt loops in order to be able to pay off the debt or at least get the deficit under control.
Yeah, and both parties, like I said, I think the next step in this process is we're heading towards helicopter drops, especially as the economy heads towards recession. And the other problem, John, that is much more complex and profound is since the 1980s is the financial, some call the financialization, securitization of the economy in the U.S. One of the chief components of our economy now is financial. We've long passed the days when you sat across the desk from a banker and he assessed your financial situation, your character, and made a loan to you. Today, the way things are securitized and financialized in this economy, you don't know where in the heck or who is holding the paper on your loan. And what we've developed is in the 50s, President Eisenhower, when he left office in 1958, talked about the military-industrial complex. Today, we built what we call the financial-political complex. I mean, you take a look at, with all due respect to Secretary Clinton, she's controlled by Wall Street. I mean, the major donors to her campaign, to the foundation, you know, tens of millions of dollars of speeches come from the financial industry. So finance controls politicians and vice versa. So what happens now is finance controls a larger percent of the economy and policy is now governed by flawed economic assumptions. And we're just getting to a situation in this country now. It's changed the dynamics of how the economy functions. And it's the dominant role. And you're seeing this in the transition, for example, with doing away with Glass-Steagall and some of the other things, financial institutions, in most particular banks, have turned in from, let's say, deposit-making and lending institutions into risk-taking institutions. Who owns all these financial derivatives? Your banks. We're also seeing the growth of what others have called the shadow banking system, which are special created vehicles to get around bank regulation and leverage concerns. We're seeing a dramatic change in the money markets, the explosion of credit derivatives, whether it's credit derivatives. 90% of those derivatives, that $650 trillion, are credit derivatives. And what makes this very dangerous is 90% is associated with interest rates and credit. And think about where we are with interest rates now. Think of what happens if there's a major sudden disruption in the interest rate markets and what happens when markets eventually lose confidence in the authorities. And the enormous growth of private equity into our markets, and the increasing reliance on mathematical models to make investment decisions, trading decisions, and economic decisions, as of you and I as consumers and individuals, can be put into a mathematical model and predict the way we're going to act. It just doesn't work that way. So what I'm really concerned, John, is in the next crisis, with the amount of derivatives out there, there will simply be a default of counterparties that set in motion a daisy chain domino effect, much as Lehman Brothers did in the fall of 2008.
Well, you sense that there is another crisis coming. Like I said, there's uneasiness. And if you look at enough of the information, there are always black swans, rogue events, which seem to trigger these types of things. But if you were peering out into the darkness, where would you say the next danger is emerging?
It's emerging with the growth of debt. I mean, we have now $200 trillion of debt out there. It's growing exponentially. We no longer have the economic growth that can service that debt, so it's not going to be repaid. So it's either going to be defaulted, inflated, or devalued. That's the only way we're going to get rid of it. And what I think it boils down to is what happens when markets start to seize up. As we have talked here, and we've did several shows on this, it's a confidence game. And once market participants realize that the counterparties to their contracts cannot honor them, when the markets and investors wake up and say, I don't have confidence in these guys. I don't have confidence in government. I don't have confidence in central banks to manage this. Once that confidence is lost, game over. And that's why this whole thing right now, John, is kind of like a masquerade. It's kind of like
a giant confidence game is what you're trying to say. It is.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz. You want to see who's behind the curtain. And I think it's going to be a loss of confidence, because how long can the Federal Reserve get up there and tell you one thing they're going to do, and then 6 weeks later change and go in the opposite direction? At some point in time, markets are going to lose confidence in government authority to right the situation. And at that point, that's when game is over, and you don't know how we will come out of it in terms of what government will look like and what the financial markets will look like. And that's why this election is probably one of the most important elections and turning points. We're either going to get this right, or, John, we're going to head down eventually to what I call inflation and devaluation, which I think is the ultimate end game.
So if we talk about deflation and evaluation as being the end game, what does that mean politically to start with? How is that going to go over in the political arena? Because most of the people that are out there, whether they're invested in the markets or not, they're trying to get on with their lives. They don't watch things as carefully as you do in these areas. And politics tends to rock with what's going on economically. And let's be honest, the president doesn't really have much control over the economics. He only has control over certain parts of it. But they don't know that. And so they'll always be throwing one group of rascals out to put another group of rascals in.
Well, you're seeing it expressed in this political election where, you know, free college, expanding Medicare, expanding Social Security, when the disability fund would have been broke this year had it not been a backroom deal that they did to extend its solvency for another year. So what will happen is, John, is you will have politicians that will devalue or explain and justify it. I mean, take a look at what Richard Nixon did in August of 1971. He took the dollar off gold backing, and everybody was saying, yeah, foreigners are really taking advantage of us. I mean, take a look at Trump and this political campaign. And, you know, Nixon devalued the dollar, took off gold backing, and he was applauded for it. So whatever measures politicians come up with will be applauded. It's kind of like, we're in trouble, do something. But nobody's asking the question if what they're doing is actually remedying the situation or actually making it worse. And that's because we have, John, what's the word I want to use with the media that isn't doing its job because it has its own political agenda?
And the reason that we have that, Jim, is that the media, which at one point was supposed to be reporting stories even-handedly, letting you see both sides, we've now polarized the media, and that the people that were generally the mainliners are representing the left side of the slate, and then Fox and the talk radio and a lot of the internet chatter goes on the right side of the slate, and the people are listening only to those things that they want to hear, and they're not hearing the whole issue hashed out to be able to make a decision. And that's a very strange situation. We've never been there before either. Okay. This is something really new in the history of news reporting. So, like you say, it's all new times, new paradigm, a new abnormal. And you have to make plans accordingly. Speaking of making plans accordingly, what's coming up in the weeks ahead?
We have one more show that we'll do, and then we're going to take our summer recess for 2 weeks. And I just want to let you know, we are planning some very exciting interviews that we're going to be doing. I'm going to be interviewing Gary Schilling, and I'm also going to be interviewing the author of a new book out called The Committee to Destroy the World, Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the Global Economy, with hedge fund manager Michael Lewitt. And also we're going to be doing an extensive On the Record coming up. So we have a lot of great stuff coming up the last 2 weeks, but next week will be our last kind of live show we do as we take our summer recess. We'll be back after Labor Day with our regular programming format. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.